Welcome to Holden Village. Today is Tuesday, July 7th, 1998. In the fireside room this morning is Walter Weingren Jr. Session number is 98-6 and is titled The Joke of the Rake. Let's listen in.
And people will still be coming in, I know, as we go, so I'll take a few minutes here at the beginning just to say nothing in particular. My name is Walt Weingren. I put together a series, a series during this week, which talks about the writer. What I have to say, I think, embraces artists in general, but I know writing better than the others, and so I may be saying some things that cross to other arts in slightly different forms that I'm unaware of. But those of you who are artists in other media, can perhaps make that transition yourself. What I'm doing is, yesterday I set up a kind of a definition of art, which it seems to me, and I would not necessarily force this on any other artist, but it seems to me, requires of me as an artist a certain kind of obligation and watchfulness. It also has to do with the kind of material that gets written, especially if it's material which endures, because it's clearly, it endures because it's fulfilling something, it's satisfying something among the people, not just a person or a group of persons, but people in general, which is very important. I mean, we do write some very, very good art sometimes that we write merely to our beloved. And maybe that's all we're thinking of, but when it's written in such a way that it begins to get a kind of a cosmic weight to it, or it speaks things that generally human beings in beloved relationships feel or yearn to say, then it endures. Anyway, so I have chosen, under my obligation as a writer, four different passions, is the way I'm saying. I really don't like that word anymore. I go to publishers, and when they don't want to accept what I've written, they usually sit down and have a really good meal. It's terribly expensive, with all kinds of wine. And at some point, they will, as the Bible says, fix their eyes upon me, and they'll say, "Walt, what is your passion to write?" And I go, this, the manuscript. and so I think that word has been devalued, but I'm using it in its old sense, that fierce and focused intensity for certain things. Yesterday we talked about craft in general. I didn't want to talk about, I could teach you the craft, but that wasn't my point. It was the relationship between the artist and the artist's craft. Today I want to talk about the other, meaning other human beings, other people, which may include the audience, but I'm not sure that's necessary. I mean, the one who actually reads the material. I think it has a lot to do with the material which is written. So I'm going to talk about the other. Tomorrow I'll talk about the stuff, the details of human living, observation, and everything from the weather to hair, and how one does or does not do it. Stuff, details, and the importance of those. And then on the last day, I would like to talk about this sort of persistent. And I find this in many, many artists, but not all recognize it, but as I said at the very beginning, this persistent sense of, as it were, tricking out the deity, tricking out divinity in a world that seems so mundane at times, or a world that it seems transfused, burning with a sense of something other than the material, also as much a part of the writing. So today, the other. Right now, on the other side, are they still watching James and the Giant Peach? Anyone looking there? When I was preparing, the kids were in there watching James and the Giant Peach, and I kept thinking that everything I said yesterday, I should have just invited you all to creep in and watch them. Because they dialogue, don't they? Little children dialogue. I mean, there's always some bigger ones going, shh, shh. But the little ones are watching, and they're not sitting there anymore. They're in that world. You know their bodies. They're out of their bodies. They're in that world. And when James says something, and they start saying, "Oh, look out, look out." You see, they're in that world. They're in the world of art at that particular moment. Somebody else's art, many people's art. All right, I want to talk about the other in two chunks. This is the first easy one. I want to talk about the result of this process and give you an example of it. A few words first, and I'm going to read an example from the Book of God. Not a terribly long one, but it's in somebody else's voice, not my own. And I think again and again, it is right and appropriate to ask, how can an artist or a writer write in a voice which is not his own? In this case, it's going to be a woman's voice. How do you get there? How do you have the right? Now, it's odd to me that lately this has become a really serious question. For much of my early writing career, nobody stopped and asked, "Walt, how do you know how women feel?" But when we got really conscious of the divisions among us and the oppressions and so forth, all of a sudden people started questioning, "Walt, how do you know how Indians feel?" You know, that I would write a novel, Lakota, and if they're willing to dialogue with me, at some point I'll say, well, and neither have I ever died, but I've written some wonderful death scenes. So there's, and so I want to talk about how that comes to be, and that's the long process I'm getting to second. Let me give you a few words and thoughts first. This is not mine, this phrase, negative capability. If you can't see it here, It says negative capability. It is the capacity to negate one's self. John Keats used this in an essay about William Shakespeare. And what Keats was knocked out with, one of the first people literally to talk about it, but everyone senses it, is that Shakespeare could write a Lady Macbeth, which was so, not just convincingly a woman, not just convincingly a woman who was in anguish, in the isolation of guilt, but that was such a substantial person there that whatever Shakespeare was vanished. You didn't see Shakespeare writing a woman. You didn't see Shakespeare even writing this particular woman, Lady Macbeth. You forgot the author altogether. And so Keats says that among certain artists, and I'll come to this a little bit, I do see this sometimes as a gift, that the artist has the capacity of negating the self so much that when the artist is writing another character altogether, another person out of one's flesh in someone else's flesh, indeed something of the artist is that other person for a while. Something of the artist is that other person for a while. So that what then is produced, I mean, then we don't ask Shakespeare, you know, how can you overcome these natural separations of humankind, which I'm going to talk about in just a little bit here. You just sit there and wonder, you forget Shakespeare. And you also forget that what's happening in the beauty of this art is that so do you, by the power of good writing, negate yourself and enter into, no matter what your gender is, no matter what your circumstance, situation, age, you enter into the particularity of something like a Lady Macbeth. And of course, Aristotle recognized this remarkable crossing of the separations years ago, 500 years before the Christian era, when Aristotle talked about tragedy and said that such things as the play Oedipus the King encouraged three things. I'm looking at Fred because he used one of those words in the previous session. Encourage us, first of all, to pity that person. See, we're not in that person. So here is Oedipus the king. We all know that Oedipus married his mother. He doesn't know that. We all know that Oedipus killed his father. He doesn't know that. And that he became the king in his father's place. He doesn't know the relationship of these people. Neither does his mother know that this is her son. He left when he was a little baby. But because of this sin, most cultures say sin without any problem. Because of this sin, there has arisen in the land a pollution. The land is polluted, it is dirty, it is despised by the gods, and all kinds of normal things are going wrong. Babies are born dead, cows are bearing sheep or dropping their young too soon. And so comes the time when this king, this marvelous and good man, Oedipus, who is the cause of all this, says, I will root the cause out no matter what it is. And then we all say, oh man, it's you, we're like the little children. Watch out! Well, and what grows in us at that point, Aristotle says, is pity. Pity is the feeling for somebody else whom we are not. No, that's wrong. Pity is the feeling for someone else who we are not. There's a clear separation. We have pity. You know, oh, those poor people, but we're not poor. There's a sort of a superiority always in pity. Mercy is different, but pity has that. And that's okay. That's the first step. But when this play works, when more and more it draws me in, it draws my spirit in, as though I, the watcher, leave my body and identify so deeply with Oedipus that I'm beginning to realize that what's happening there is imminently probable, if not likely, for me. Under other circumstances. All of a sudden, I'm not in the audience. And the word at this point that Aristotle uses for our feeling is fear. Now we have the fear, the quaking and elemental fear that Oedipus himself is about to experience when suddenly all is made known to him and he cries out. And he cries out, his mother has hanged herself. Comes that horrible thing, which they always do off stage. In our American society, in our movies, we just try to get as much blood on stage as we can. But they would do it off stage. Off stage goes Oedipus the king, and there is Jocasta, his mother, hanging because she saw and is horrified. And she has these two brooches on her dress, and he grabs those brooches off her dress off stage. But we know it's happening. And as her own dress falls, so does his sight. He pierces his eyes with the pins of those brooches and blinds himself. well, and there we are, you know, and when it works, we're not, you know, we're going like this. Ah, that's the consequence. Same thing happens, you know, if you tell the creation story wrong, and so forth and so on. All right, that's negative capability then for the audience. I use this phrase and like it a lot. The question is, how do we do that? How do we get there? I like this phrase. I call it the sympathetic imagination. Sympathos, this feeling with. Two words put together become sympathy. Sympathos, feeling with. It could be suffering with, dancing with, except in emotions. Some of you know Hans Christian Andersen and his stories. This man had remarkable sympathetic imagination. Somebody said to him once, I'll bet you can't write about anything I give you. And he says, I bet I can. So the guy picked up a needle. He said, write about a needle. And I can go find that story right now, how he imagined himself. He had that sympathos into a needle, which in fact what he was making was a small child, stiff and unable to move. That when he wrote it in such a way that we also traveled with. Sympathetic imagination will build with what I'm telling you here. But I think most artists who deal somehow or other with the presence of other human beings learn this. That is to say that if I read you well enough, at some point, particularly when I write, I will fetch up within you and I will know your feeling, not because I'm objectively studying it, but because I'm feeling it. Let me read you an example. There are four things, this is not a terribly long one, from the Book of God. When I write, when this works, I write under the urgency of getting it right. Four things I'm going to put here, those who can't see it on the board. Getting what I write right, just in terms of the frank detail and the lingo and the language, especially when it's not my language and when it's another being. I want to write in such a way that that character comes for you alive as you read it and you say, yeah, there's a living thing. So one, I want to get it right so that you're not all sitting there saying, no, that wouldn't happen. No, she wouldn't say that. Number two, I want that person to be alive. Number three, once the reader discovers the living person there, I would like engagement, some kind of a relationship to exist between you, so that, like with Oedipus, so that when my character gets into some trouble or begins to unfold a mystery, that you care about what's happening. I learned that early. If you're going to read the Book of the Duncow, somewhere early I've got to get you to care about those characters. And there are multitudes of ways of doing it, but those of you who have read the Book of the Duncow, ultimately it's not an accident that we begin with humor, that you laugh and you giggle around these really odd and queer figures, and partly because they're representing figures you know. If I get you to laugh, I get you. If I get you truly to belly laugh, that's why I don't write wit and irony. I don't mean ironic laughter, which separates you. Those silly people. No, if I get you to laugh, I've got you. Because you release your soul at laughter. You release that breath, you understand. I mentioned the other day. One more thing. This is going to end out here in just a little bit. You can hear the beginning of the engines, you see. They're going to go. Yeah, they're all really sad. Yeah. Did anyone ever see, I should not do this. Watch it, but, well, did anyone ever see Bonnie and Clyde, that movie? It was a turning point in film, actually. Because this is the first time they ever had that slow motion murder shot at the end, where Bonnie and Clyde are coming out of that car, and in slow motion you see the bullets pop, pop, hit them. And I had heard about that before I went, and people spoke about how what happened in that film is that they turned the dead cold eye on people who were interesting, and you might like them, but who were evil people. And then they made you feel pity when they were shot to death at the end. And the pity was terrible, said some people to me. I said, that's not going to happen to me. I'll go watch that, and I'll say, yeah, let's watch the technique here. But if you've seen that movie, you know they do something up front that got me. It's funny. It really is funny up front. They make me laugh. And when they laugh, they have me. It's a little bit like this. It's like when two people say, let me punch you in the stomach, and you can punch me in the stomach and see who hurts us the most. And you punch me in the stomach, and I have my stomach all tight. Of course, you're really strong in your stomach, too. So I'm getting ready to punch you in the stomach. But just before I punch you in the stomach, I do this. I make you lose that consciousness. And in that instant of snap, they relax. And boy, I can just throw your tongue out of your mouth. That's what humor does. Get you to laugh, and I got you. But the part I'm reading here is not funny. I'm going to read Leah. There's a passage in here, you remember the wife of Jacob together with Rachel. I'm going to read Leah. I want to say two things before I read it. You know the story, I suspect, that the tricky Jacob was tricked by his uncle Laban. Jacob loved Rachel, who was the second oldest daughter, and worked 7 years in order to marry her. And when the marriage came, in the evening, the wife was so veiled that he only just assumed. You know, this is sometimes, this is the cunning danger of loving so much, that when you look at your beloved, you see what you love, but it may not be your beloved. No, it's the cunning danger of loving too much your imagination of what your beloved ought to be. You understand? And that happens a lot. We love this person so much we think it's that person, but we just changed things a little bit. We love what we want that person to be, which is going to cause great distress later on for that person as well as for us. So, you know, maybe there were veils, maybe there weren't that many, but, you know, he was so stuck on Rachel, he was sure that's who it was. And then, of course, it wasn't, and he got really angry, and it was Leah. And again, as I was writing the Book of God, I kept thinking, how do these people that we have silent, how would they talk if they could? And Leah is one of those. Now, she's not totally silent. So you understand the circumstance here. She's going to write about it after Rachel is married, too. And the second thing I've got to say is thanks to Fred Niener. Some of you in the sessions here know how much he uses the Hebrew and the Greek to understand linguistically what's going on behind. Well, he's the one who made me understand that the names that Leah gives her first four children kind of identify where her soul is and what's happening. The first three names, Fred showed me, have to do with the relationship between Leah and Jacob. The fourth name, Judah, has to do with her relationship between herself and God. And there's a sense, and this is Fred, there's a sense of release in there. So I take material like that. But I also take what I'm going to tell you, and I try to create a voice for her, and this is Leah. When my husband discovered that I was not my sister, I did not blame him for his anger. I had expected anger.
Sorry.
Yeah, I'm hearing those goodbyes too, and I want you to sort of, like the children, I want you to melt in here. Yeah. Just pretend that this is
there goes
the giant peach. Now we'll wait. A little bit of tears, a little bit of chit-chat.
Yeah.
This door is about to open, I promise you. Let's see if Anderson's going to make it all the way around. Yeah, here comes Anderson. Slow, long, naked-legged stride. Anderson, he walks like this. You know, he's like a tree with two trunks because they're so skinny, he needs two. Holds his head on high like the globe of fruit that has never been picked. And therefore, a little winter is over the years. Well, he just went by the door. When he was little, he prayed to God. He said, "Oh Lord, let me walk on stilts." God has been answering that prayer ever since. Now I'm going to read from the Book of God, Leah, her voice, not mine, her language, I hope, not mine. When my husband discovered that I was not my sister, I did not blame him for his anger. I had expected anger. I only hoped he would not hit me, and he didn't. He scarcely looked at me. At me, I mean. He did not see Leah. He saw not Rachel. Mine was the more elaborate wedding, of course, being first. Louder, more food, more guests. It was when he led my sister into the same room where 1 week earlier he had led me. It was when he asked me to leave my new house and return to my mother's house a while. It was when he went into my sister fully knowing who she was and able, therefore, to call her by name. It was then that I surprised myself with sorrow. I had said I would not love him, but I failed. Thereafter, I cooked well, and he praised my food, but he lingered over Rachel's. At shearing time, he weighed our portions of wool evenly. Each bundle was the balance of the other, but Rachel's wool when it was washed, showed not a fiber that was not white. I tried to hide my sorrow. It had not been planned that I should love Jacob. Nor was it his fault that I did, so he did not see my heart, but the Lord saw. The Lord soon opened my womb, and I conceived, and I carried the baby 9 months, and I bore for my husband his firstborn son. I named him Reuven, because the Lord had looked upon my affliction, and I thought, surely now my husband too will notice me. Not long after that, I conceived again and bore another son, and I thought, because the Lord has heard that I am hated, he has given me this son also, so I named him Simeon. Again I conceived and bore a son, and I called him Levi. I thought that surely now my husband would be joined to me, seeing that I had borne him 3 sons. Well, but I who was rich in one thing was poor in the other. Jacob loved his children, yes, and since that first night he never more looked with anger at me. Simply, he did not look at me with anything at all, neither a thought nor a word nor a feeling. When he looked at me, he did not see Leah. He saw not Rachel. While I was bearing children all those years, my sister was barren. She was unhappy. So Jacob was unhappy too. I heard them whispering at midnight. She said, Jacob, either you give me children like Leah or I shall die. He said, oh, Rachel, do you think I am in the place of God? I am not the one who closed your womb. When, therefore, I conceived and bore another son, I no longer sought the love of my husband by means of my children. I said out loud, this time I will praise the Lord, and I named the baby Judah. But this fourth child tormented my sister. She stopped talking to me. She ignored my 4 sons. And if ever she was saying something to Jacob when I drew near, she broke it off and glared at me. I saw that Jacob's shoulders began to droop and his eyes grew tired. Then I saw that Rachel's maid Bilhah was with child, and I understood. Bilhah bore the baby upon my sister's knee, so it was considered to be Rachel's. And as soon as she saw that the baby was a boy, she cried, God has judged me and has heard my voice and has given me a son. She named him Dan to commemorate this judgment of God. Within a year, Rachel's maid bore another son. I was not in the room at that time, yet the whole family heard Rachel's voice ring out when the boy was born. She said, with mighty wrestlings have I wrestled with my sister, and I have prevailed. The word she used for wrestle is Niphtal. So she named the baby Naphtali. Shall I be blamed for offering my husband my maid then too? By Zilpah I bore 2 more sons. I named the first one Gad, because he was for me good fortune, and the second Asher, happy. And why should I not be happy, seeing that I was now the mother of 6? Still my sister was not happy. One morning during the wheat harvest, my oldest son found mandrake roots, roots shaped like a little man. They help women to bear boys. Rachel must have noticed. That afternoon, she came to the threshing floor where I was working. She picked up the flail and began to beat the wheat beside me. And then she astonished me by speaking. Give me some of Reuben's mandrake, she said. Those are the first words my sister had spoken to me in more than 10 years. God forgive me, mine were no kinder than hers. Why should I said. Does the woman who stole my husband's love now want my son's roots too? Jacob visits you, she said. Not for years, Rachel, I said. With Zilpah, yes, not with me. Rachel said, not for a single night. Well, you tell me which night he has not been with you, and that will be the night he spent with me. Not one? None. Rachel fell silent, swinging her double stick, thumping the hard dirt, beating the wheat sheaves into kernel and chaff, while I said nothing. I had covered my face with my skirt. I did not want my sister to see that I was crying. But then she stopped threshing, and I felt her hand on the back of my neck. Leah, she said, let's make a trade. I'll give you nights with Jacob, this night now and others hereafter, and we will not be enemies anymore, but sisters. And will my sister then give me some of her son's mandrake roots? This is the moment in my story which I most want to tell you, that I embraced my sister. We burst into tears and held one another, and I found how deeply I loved her. No, I had never ceased to love the beautiful Rachel. The mandrake did not help her, but she helped me. I bore two more sons and a daughter after that, and for each birth, my sister was my midwife. We named the first of these Issachar and the second Zebulun and the little girl Dinah, and that was the end of my childbearing. I gave birth to no more children, but my sister did. Finally, God hearkened to our ceaseless prayer on her behalf and opened her womb, and the entire family rejoiced when Rachel conceived and bore a son. On that day, Jacob remembered how to smile again. Oh, his face was a flood of sunlight. I was happy. He was happy. And Rachel gave beautiful voice to her own happiness. She said, "The Lord God has taken my reproach away." She named her first son Joseph, and lo, I was her midwife. So, you know, you do this and you have to live within the times that people lived in. I could not lie about the male-female thing and the dominance and all that, but what I could do is allow Leah herself, as I wrote this, to start telling me how it was women lived underneath such circumstances. How was it that they were able to maintain a wholeness of personality in spite of what was wrong? And when I began writing that, I promise you, I had not thought through the relationship between the sisters as well as I did when I was actually writing the thing itself. And to me, it grew as a kind of blossomed revelation. And you notice, Jacob plays almost no role in this. I mean, there he is getting sad, getting grumpy, having babies, saying, "I'm not God, what do you think?" and all that sort of stuff. There he is off. But here begins this small cosmos, this world among them. And really, I thought as I wrote that, when if sisters become midwives, and there's nothing in the Bible that says that, but Leah said that to me, if sisters become midwives, and the one thing that they are doing is they're holding their hand right on the genesis of the people. Whatever happens thereafter, for a while those babies were under their hands, and let the fathers go stalk and hunt and bring home the money and work late. Call them and say they're working late, or preach sermons. Anyway, thanks. That's Leah. I hope it reads some people. And I say, you want to get it right, you want them to be alive, you want to engage. And then finally I say, the fourth is, I hope the character becomes thy glove, that you, as a hand, move into that. And for a little while, that's where you dwell. Now, I suspect that if you read through the Bible, I mean, through the book of God, up till that point, then you would have come into it much more easily than my announcing it to you. So then, quickly. The long process that gets a writer to the point where perhaps another character lives or a whole novel works around has three parts to it. And there is a kind of a sequence to these parts. Early on, one learns how to read other people as if they were a language themselves, their postures, their faces, their moods, their colors, all the business about human beings, their tone of voice. Somewhere in this process, it helps for an artist to love one other human being in a particular way, which I want to talk about, because that allows an entering into that other human being and overcoming the divisions that exist. But then finally is loving others generally and with a sense of our all being a part of the same soup, you know. And that's even larger than loving one other, and it requires the sacrifice of self. The first one, you must be aware. The second, the self dwells in another, and the third, the self is sacrificed. That's a sequence I'd like to go through. It's up here if I lose you on the way. Let's start with the beginning. There are some of us who are more capable of reading the faces, the postures, are reading the souls, the minds, and the emotions of other people than others are. And I put down four ways in which this capacity to read other human beings, beyond what the human beings say, beyond what their words are, but truly to enter into some understanding of what's going on interior, what the motives are, what those secret things are, which are either consciously or unconsciously hidden. And, you know, there may be others than this, but just at least so we understand what goes on. Many, many people do this who never become artists. That's all right. They become healers. They become therapists. They become teachers. They become those who work very well with other people. Let me start with this. I think children by nature have a kind of capacity to read more than what their parents say to them. And then they lose that pretty quickly. Well, you know, it's gone at the age of adolescence. I mean, they refuse to read within it at all. Then they crank up walls between you. And whatever. But I do think, and I want to, this is going to be very simplistic, and we can talk long on each one of these points, but you see, I think for children, and I'm not false with this language, their lives depend upon reading others because they are, in effect, so helpless, no matter how much they seem to control the house. Their lives depend. The reason that they know that a certain screech, the reason that they know that a certain cry, screech, at a certain tone with a certain length will make you give them what they want. The reason they know that a certain screech with a certain tone and a certain length in the grocery store will make them give you what they want is because they read you in the first place, and they were exceedingly, even before their little brains were altogether conscious, they tested, I mean, a certain shriek showered them with exactly what they wanted. So they're watching you, and pretty soon then, if they control you, they'll stop reading you more and more, and they'll demand that you read them more and more. I mean, that happens at the very beginning. There's this natural reading back and forth. I watch the mother who changes the baby's diapers, knowing more and more how that baby is thinking, and it's, to me, it's almost miraculous that they're inside of that little wordless thing. I mean, they're inside of the thing that can't even make words up on this, but the baby will do something, he'll say, oh, honey, do you such and such and such? Okay, here it is. And that's exactly what the baby wanted. So the love of the mother makes them read this ineffable language. You know, this language was just like a blank page to me while I'm watching. Well, how did you know that? Well, she told me that. But the children do as well at the beginning, and especially when their lives depend upon it. So I think it's natural to children. The issue is whether one preserves it into consciousness or not and makes it a conscious tool for the reading of other people. When a child is oppressed, when people generally are oppressed, the same principle works. And it is the phrase, because their lives depend upon it. I don't know if any, well, in my childhood, I had to read my mother very carefully because I had to know ahead of her knowing what she felt. Because if I wasn't watchful and careful, what she felt might affect me. I mean, I might be hurt by it. And in my heart, it was a big thing. My life depended upon reading my mother. Am I making sense to you? Yeah, maybe some of you remember that as well. It's the person who can give you love or withhold it. It's the person who can hurt you in other ways, and who hurts you not according to some very clear standard or law outside of themselves, but according to what's going on inside of themselves. These children, and then not just children, but the oppressed, get really, really good at reading the signs, the tones of voices, the posture, the hunch in the shoulders, the speed of the walk. I mean, it's almost infinite, the number of ways in which people unconsciously give forth what they're feeling. And so I think, you know, one, by the way, it is true, especially children's writers, that many of them have had some kind of crisis in their childhood, whether it is for their parents or the loss of parents or loneliness or sending off. There's a marvelous essay by a writer named Cameron, who now has since died, where she just simply gathers the information of children's writers like Hans Andersen and shows trauma. I take the next step and I say those who have had to survive under trauma have, for their own life's sake, for their sanity and their peace and getting food, had to read the faces of others. Why do you think Dickens does so well in his always skewed off descriptions of other people to show you exactly how they were? Because as a child, he lived by that kind of sight. And I tell you, it's such quick reading, you must read before the one who is feeling it knows it. This, dear people, is why, under the slavery period and even thereafter, the African Americans in this country could read their white oppressors infinitely better than their white oppressors could read them. Although, and this is always the danger of oppression and prejudice, the white oppressors were sure that they understood the black. It was a vast irony, but they had the power. They didn't have to read. They had the power. They didn't want to read. They wanted to impose their reading upon the blacks. Now, that same thing with men and women, is that throughout the ages, when men and women like Leah, Rachel, and Jacob were in relationships where lives depended upon it, the women read the man first. And what they did with that was a multitude of things, but I know that sometimes it was because their lives depended upon it. So you're granted a kind of a skill that nobody recognizes, but it's the skill of swimming so that you do not drown. And then you never forget that ever thereafter. I never forgot it. I lived by it constantly, and partly because also I'm this person too. And many artists are. They are just by nature fiercely self-conscious, so much aware, dreadfully aware of the self. I mean, it's that teenager, it's that girl teenager who wants so much to dance or to be in and basketball or what have you, but goes out on the floor, and as she walks on the floor, crowded with other people, she's walking on the floor, and she has this feeling that up in the ceiling, somebody has a spotlight. And they dimmed all the other lights, and they're showing that spotlight right on that poor girl who's walking out. And now that she's in this spotlight of self-consciousness, she is just burningly aware of her braces. She knows exactly how she's not able to walk gracefully. She knows exactly how she's walking, you understand. She knows what color her skin is, what her dress is. Oh, she should have chosen that other, all that stuff. And when she opens up her mouth to talk, she knows exactly how it sounds. What's happening in this self-consciousness? It's the same thing with this too, is that at this point, one is reading one's self. One is learning deeply and complexly the language of the self. Now, when that same person moves out of self-consciousness, releases that at various times, now that person will look at another person and will recognize perfectly that little quiver of the lip. No one else will see it, but she'll read it because she knew that quiver when she was looking at herself. Do you understand? That's the second level. Granted, I think there are many people who do become artists or therapists or what have you, this capacity, you know, we call it shyness. And most of my life, I just hated it. I still hate it. In public forum, I can do really good looking like I know what I'm talking about and I'm at peace and comfortable. But very often in sudden meetings and you know, Than and I, when we first got married, she wanted to go to parties and I always took a book. I always took a book. And I mean, this to me, I'm talking about anguish, the anguish of self-consciousness. I would find a corner off and read my book. And I would usually take a fat book, you know, because I was giving out all these signs, don't sit down next to me, don't talk to me. Well, I remember once in college, you know, I didn't go out with people, girls, a lot because of this criminal self-consciousness that I had. But, you know, all my friends, they set me up with this one girl and we were at a dance and I don't dance. Good Lord. And not only do I have to be careful about how I move, but there's all these people around looking. But I remember I had just been hitchhiking all summer through Europe, which I did very, very well for about 4 or 5 months on $200. And they brought me at this dance, this is with nurse people who are becoming nurses, a woman who stood next to me, and they left me there. So here we are standing. And this is exactly how the conversation went. I said, well, I just traveled Europe. And she said, just a minute, I have to have a cigarette and we have to smoke in the girls' bed. Never saw her again. That confirmed it, you know. So there is this fierce self-consciousness, you know, that people are sometimes born with. And then comes that moment of release, which happens over here sometimes. The release comes when you really do have affections or feeling or identification for or sympathy with the people around you. And even if you don't become involved with them, you do at that moment read, you watch. By the way, that's why when a child sees his mother cry, his face takes exactly her conformity first. He gets her exactly where her face is. See, this is all talk to children. And then he cries. And then he cries, and it's real tears. Oh, he's as sad as she is, though he has no understanding of why they're crying. Sympathos. Similar circumstance. This happens too, but I want to caution you all. This is what we use the most. Somebody comes by and they have a broken arm, and it's their right arm and so forth and so on. Another person says, oh yeah, I had that broken arm. And don't you just feel like... In other words, again and again, we have had certain experiences, and then we see that somebody else has the experience, and yes, that grants us a little insight into how they're feeling, particularly if they are painful or unique experiences. And very often that is what creates kind of unity among people. I am alienated from my society because I have such and such a thing. I meet another person who's alienated, and therefore we can establish a rapport and a dialogue because we have some same stuff between us. That works as well. The caution I put there is sometimes that which starts conversation kills it. Again and again, a person will come and say, yes, I had the same experience as you, and then not listen, only talk. And then not listen for the variations and the difference. And in effect then, impose upon this person my own experience within that circumstance and never listen again. That's much of the danger. And I say this to all of us, dear people, all of us. It's easier for us to remember our experience than to wait upon the experience of the person facing us. Waiting upon is that biblical concept. It's easier for us as pastors. I had a fight when someone would come into my office with a problem that I could counsel. I had a fight immediately upon hearing the problem. to give, you know, to open up my mental drawer and say, let's see, oh yeah, that's the problem. Well, here's the solution, okay, and give that solution. I never had in my mental drawer exactly what this person had. I had classifications that would put me in the ballpark, but at some point you listen, you don't impose. Therapists do this, pastors do this. You know, we get really good at healing four things. And isn't it amazing that everybody who comes in has one of those four things? Listen, read, listen, read, empathetically. I don't care how much listening we think we do with our cell phones and our email and so forth and so on. We don't. I'm sorry, people. We talk. We question. Questions are bad because what they do is tell the person what they should say in response. Even if you're asking for a complex response, you're saying, this conversation is going to take place in this room under this topic. Now, what do you think? That's not allowing another person to become wholly human in front of you. It comes because you learn how to listen, and this is one of the blessings of being shy. This is one of the blessings of being the fifth or the third wheel, is that you're forced to listen. And you get really good at asking the question that merely opens up. You've got to do that if you're going to read other people. You've got to listen. You cannot assume. The most deadly thing against the reading of other people is prejudice. The most deadly thing against reading the other people is a prejudgment upon them. It's presuming when you meet them that by five characteristics, you got their number. It's presuming by reading them, even according to 150 characteristics, you got their number, because they'll always be the 151st. Be prepared to be surprised. Let me continue. Loving the other, entering in. Last night I made the confession. I was so surprised at myself that I was the pastor of an African-American congregation and understood racism so much, discovered after a while racism in myself. But the next thought that I want to give you is, this I begin to believe. I could not truly have understood racism. I really could not have understood the black experience. I could not. Walt Weinberg, white skin, raised among white people, even though I went and lived a long time, I could not have understood what it is that the black people go through, except first I loved one with my whole heart. Because then what happened to my son happened to me. This is a very important thing to say. I could not presume. I mean, I can do a lot of reading. This is the next step. I can do a lot of reading of what women are and what they feel, and I could get really, really good at that. I could read in a kind of an intellectual way, even an emotional, sympathetic way, but I could not react as if I were the woman unto whom it was happening, except first I loved one. And she had the grace to allow me to love her and love me back. Now when they do things to my son, Matthew, it goes straight to my soul. And I know what this is. But I can tell you honestly, there is a separation among us, and we may think we know. And if ever we think we know it all, then we probably will stop knowing right there. When we know it is when it's my heart who drives that big, what do we have, a Buick? Big old 78 car. My heart gets stopped. My heart can expect to get stopped on an average once or twice a month, no matter where he pleases to drive in this country. In Minneapolis, in Evansville, in Chicago, in especially in small little white towns, my son Matthew will be stopped by the police. This is just common. And they will not just stop and say, you know, how are you, what you're doing? They will ask him to get out of the car and they will search it. This is against the law, but this is their discretion. And you will ask, you will say to the police, do you know what discrimination and racism you are enacting upon young black males in big cars? And on the one hand, they'll say, no, it's not. And they'll talk about fitting the profile. And in some cases, that's absolutely right. But I know what it feels like, not because I'm black, but because I desperately love one who is. That's how I learn. You enter into another. I want to clarify this kind of loving. First of all, let me say, this is over against the separations that are very real among us. I lay out here three kinds of separations, which right now exist in this world, some talked about and used and some not. And because of these separations, the conclusion is, no human being can truly know another human being. Well, I'm going to tell you honestly that I think it is monumentally difficult for a human being to know another. I do not diminish how difficult that is and what it requires of one and the other. For a true fetching up, dwelling within. The self enters into another. I know how difficult it is. I know how difficult it is. When I feel alienated and lonely, I know it. There's a Star Trek in the whole first series that just moved me when I saw it. Two spirit beings wanted to enter into the flesh. And they asked Uhuru and what's his name, Captain Kirk, could we enter into your flesh, spirit beings? And when they entered in, here's what they said. They said two things. The first was they said, how beautiful. Because the implication is spirits don't apprehend the way we do. They just know. But now they knew by seeing colors, shapes, smells, taste, the senses, touch. And they looked at the world, which they had never seen before. It never occurred to me. Spirits don't see. They just know. They looked at the world they'd never seen before. They walked in the world they'd never felt before. And they said, how beautiful. But the very next comment nearly killed me. It is this human tragedy. They said, and how lonely. That we dwell within self. And we always must mediate our knowledge by talk, by touch. We must mediate it. It's not immediate. Well, and I know how difficult it is. But I promise you, I think three things can cross it. I think this artist's mentality is a piece of it. I think love crosses it. I think this is one of the miraculous powers of a good love, which I'm going to describe very quickly in just a minute. But I also think that this is where when churches talk about spirit, when religions talk about community and spirit, this is not exclusive to the Christian religion, that there always is this sense that yes, in certain communities, there is in flashing moments, which although they are brief, consume and embrace the entire world. They're cosmic moments. In a moment, we are one. In a moment. And when in the Christian church, now I'm on a hobby horse. But when in the Christian church, we fight each other. And we blame each other. And we say, you can't know me, and so forth. And I'll never know you. And then we divide. Well, we are, I think, eliminating that whole concept of the third person. That is to say, that Holy Spirit, in whom this miracle can happen in moments of storytelling, touch, complete shared Eucharist. So we have these separations, which, no, they're not easy to cross, but may. The first one now, which is in existence, I call the power and the citadel of political separation, where I use my particular kind of a pain to separate from you, and I empower myself by saying, well, you're the cause of why I hurt. And you will never understand why I hurt. And so I withdraw from you to all these people like me who have hurt. And in this kind of withdrawing, what we do on the one hand is we strike you with guilt. We strike you down and declare your powerlessness. You can't know me. You will never be able to know us. And on the other hand, we build for ourselves a powerfulness. Now, let me say two things quickly. One, yes, that's necessary. If you listened at all last week to Mike, speaking color, he talks about organization and this necessity of self-interest. Yes, in this left-handed world, I don't know left or right, I'm talking about Luther. In this left-handed world, in this world of power, where people only know power, what I just described is necessary. Are you with me? So we do create political entities and power blocks by our wound. We do diminish the other people if we can. What do you think Democrats and Republicans are doing all the time anyway? What do you think the rich are doing constantly except quietly and in lapels? Mm-hmm. But the horrible fallout of that is that it tears asunder the potential of human beings truly to dwell one in the other. And there's a whole nother kind of healing which is not power at all. The second kind of loneliness is existential, and I just talked to you about that. That sense that in myself, I cannot ever come out. I remember once with Than, when we were courting, and I tried to... Is she here? I tried to touch her hand exactly the same way she was touching my hand, so I could believe that in that moment we were at least feeling exactly the same thing. And she didn't know it, but I was quietly going through my own little Wally trauma. I was despairing because I couldn't be sure that touching her exactly, we were existential. I know this with all my heart, this loneliness where I want so badly to tell you who I am. But the words never get it right and you're busy. And the hell of sin and separation. I have to continue so that I don't take too long with all of this. I want to tell you a story. And then I'll touch this last. This does have to do with my son Matthew. And that's why I've allowed this whole issue of the separation to lurk. And what I began to learn through my son Matthew. I talked about the boys playing basketball in the backyard, and they did, and ultimately that was really a blessed thing. When Matt went to high school, he had, remarkably, when he was a sophomore, he was called to the varsity to be point guard. Matt was always short, but he has an exceedingly astonishing vertical jump. I mean, he started playing basketball at the height of, I think at that point he was about 5'7". And they had big guys on this team. This is Bossy. This is Bossy High School in Indiana. In Evansville, Indiana, which is one in Indiana. Do you understand? I'm talking about Indiana. My son Matt was so fast, he could never jump high enough to slam dunk. But he could fire himself. A whole group, he was just surprising. Boing! How come this brown head, this brown face, and over all the heads he would shoot? He was point guard, too, and he had excellent vision of the field. And the team, although Bossy High School was naturally integrated, the team was mostly black. There were one or two white faces on it as well. And Matthew became something of a leader in that team. And partly because the basketball court was in our backyard for the whole neighborhood. And partly because Matt could cut hair. Well, you know, before every game, those guys had to come and have their hair cut. Every one of them. And then they put racing stripes. Long before the white kids ever did this stuff on the side of their hair, the black kids were doing it. And still the white kids are, and now, you know, Matthew would do things like put their initials on top, and they wouldn't even know it. You know, cut that hair really close and put a big white T for Tim on top, or racing stripes. And he was the one who had that blue ghost, we call it, that car. So he would drive them to and fro. And had a certain sense of, he had a gentle leadership. I mean, he was not loud, and he would always stand back to read a situation first before it happened. Well, in January of his senior year at Bossy, they were going to play in a county at Heritage High School, a county in southern Indiana. Perhaps you know about southern Indiana outside of the cities. It always made us nervous for them to play Jasper County or various places because it's unrelievedly white. It's white athwart. It's aggressively white. It's white, we know it's white, and we're really happy with ourselves. And often when they would go play in these places, this was just common that the fans of the other team would come out with fake watermelons and hubcaps and stuff like that. Well, and they considered that it was fun and so forth like that. And our kids got used to it. And what they would usually do is take the court at the beginning. That is to say, when they burst on the court, these tall black figures would circle it, and they would continue to do slam dunks, just one after the other, and then Matthew. Slam dunk, Matthew. But in effect, what they were doing was, you know, they were like leaving their scent. They were taking the court. They were declaring their presence. And then they often would win. Only this one time in dark January, it was dark, as they came to Heritage High School, and they turned, this is in the country now, they turned across a railroad track in order to get into the lot. Someone started a fire. Matthew told me that someone started a fire just outside of the bus where he was, and he thought that was really curious. Why would they start a fire here? It's just on the side of the railroad tracks, and it was right by the bus. If he had the open window, he could touch it. He touched the fire that flared up. It went right up like a fountain in front of his window. And then he said it went out like open arms. And he said that his mouth got really, really dry when he looked at that, and that he couldn't swallow. And he said he thought, why would they burn a cross? He said, why would they burn the cross of Jesus? But you know there's something so deep in the black psyche. And there's something about this kind of symbolic language so deep that although Matthew could not put words to it, he knew how ugly and evil and dividing and separating, how murderous this symbol was. He said the whole bus got real quiet. He said they didn't know what they were going to do. When they suited up, should they go around them and do their slam dunking? He said when they walked out, they just walked out quietly because now, you know, it turned out to have been just three people. But in your minds, you don't know who, and when you don't know who, it's all the people. It's all these people, all these white faces. Doggone it, people, just once go among blacks and be the only white, to have the beginning of a sense. And if you feel threatened, you think, yeah, but these blacks are all so big and strong. If you feel threatened among the blacks, multiply that when you're black among the whites. Because when you are among blacks, you're in a puddle. When you're among blacks, you might even be swimming in a lake. When blacks are among whites in this particular country, they're in the ocean. It's endless. So they walked out, and there's all these white faces, and they're laughing, and they're doing their things, and Watermelon Knot has a whole other feel. And they began to play the game. And Matthew said, it was just terrible that first half. I mean, you're conscious of something which has no words nor any focus. You're conscious as if in this whole place there is someone making a deep sound. You know, I almost think about the world serpent, Loki monster, that great world serpent which is just under the crust of the world and is so huge that it can pass around the earth once and bite its own tail ahead of it. That Loki monster of Norse mythology groaning. Oh. And its groan is just beneath hearing. It's just subliminal. Oh. So you don't hear it, but everything trembles with it. And I think that that groaning could be hatred or, you know, this calm sort of separation where nobody hates anybody, they're just having fun, but it's dangerous. Having fun with a loaded gun. Little kid, I'm just having fun, pow, is murderous. They ran, if I can get you to understand this, I understand this because this is my heart out there. They ran on a floor that trembled with that groan. You could just feel that vibration under your feet. And when the whole earth and the element you're on groans with that, how do you think about where is this person to give that shot to? How do you make yourself completely alert, broadly, not just focused, to the whole field? Jordan, I really believe watching him, I think one of the things that Jordan does magnificently is that he's got one calm and serene spot in his mind. And no matter how hard his body is playing Michael Jordan, no matter how furious he seems to be, there is that little gyroscope that never loses its balance. So that there's a calm part up here that's swiftly making wordless decisions. The best athletes are like that. But let that earth tremble, and there's no calmness up here, and you can't see second sight anymore. You've got to think hard. And so they were beginning to lose. And at the halftime, they went into the room just dejected, because they were, in fact, losing, and they shouldn't have. And they sat around with their heads down, and that coach was no help. I'm sorry. I wrote a column once which was rejected by Trex. That's my editor for the Lutheran, in which I said, why do coaches always have to shout? I said that. I said, English teachers don't get to shout. I said, if those who taught science screamed at kids and brought them down and made them feel little, they wouldn't have a job soon. But this is supposed to create, I don't know, men. Women. Shouting at them all the time. What is this shouting? And that's not just, what's his name, Knight. At IU. It's a bunch of these coaches for high school. And we had a shouter. We had a little white apoplectic shouter. We had this little pink shouter who would go red in his face when he shouted. And he chose at that point to shout at these kids. It was just down and down. But he was not shouting against them. He was shouting because he was angry at what was happening. I need to be really clear. At this point, he was not putting them down, but he wasn't helping them. He is shouting, you get out there and you show them. You show them who's the boss, all that kind of stuff, which was no good for them at all. He got all red in his face. I know this. I know this. This is my heart. I have entered in. I know this. The kind of love which is... I'll finish the story in a minute. The kind of love which allows this... Let me just quick say four things about it. Number one, it cannot, dear people, be a love of dominance, but one of humility. We tend to dominate those we love, especially when we are nourishing them. We're feeding them, making decisions for them. We tend to be the one who dominates the relationship. But as much as one dominates the relationship, so much does one not know about the little echoes and the feelings that are in the other. And you can make those decisions without, you know, letting the other one run over you. Bonhoeffer talks about the difference between spiritual and human love. And he says that human love always looks for its own satisfaction, even when it seems to be serving. Even when it seems to be serving the others, looking for something in return. I think there needs to come that spiritual moment when love is not looking for, are you with me, you know, and are we okay, and just give me a little kiss right there, just a little kiss. But when it's a genuine sense of the other's presence fulfilling and filling the world. Number two, however, you must love the other, as I said, not your image of the other. And you know, you love a little kid, the little kid keeps growing. When I was in college or high school, one way my mother could speak love to me was by saying, Wowie. Well, and she's more comfortable with my being a child instead of a person who had grown up, you know, and I had hair in odd places and things like that. She'd say, "Wowie," to me, and I knew it was happening. The image that she was loving at that point, I had left years and years ago. Same thing among other people. No, you cannot. You have to love the other, not the image. Number two, it's got to be love and not worship. This is the opposite. When you love somebody so much that they are the God of your life, they are the core and the meaning and the substance of your whole life. And that happens. Parents to children, male, female, partners. You love someone so much to distraction, you could do away with God. Because this has become the full core and balance and meaning of life. A lot of our songs say this. The trouble is that when you worship the other, you may never know the other, because what you will know is what the other tells you. And the relationship now will not be one of this watchful learning, it'll be one of command. And if the other one doesn't want to be your God, it still is command, and it really drives her crazy. What do you want? No, what do you want? What do you want? No, just tell me what you want, and I'll do it. You want to have? Do you understand what I'm saying? Sometimes we love another person so much, and they don't want that, but they see that every little gesture I make, that person takes it as a command. And here I am putting my cup down, and whoosh, 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 it's full. I didn't want more coffee, but see, that was a... You understand. Okay, talk fast. It has to be love and not worship. And finally, I should read Buber to you at this point about I and thou. It cannot be this objective love where you're simply watching the details of the other person. When I was going to write about the Lakota, I was invited to spend time on the reservation. I went thinking I would take notes. That's objective. I would stand back and make its out of them. I would see their height, their weight, their activities, and so forth and so on. That's objective. When I got there, through a series of experiences, I realized I should not take notes. I should not be that moment, that minimal degree apart from them that I was a researcher. I should allow them to become thou to me. I should stand and take my existence in the light of their presence. Read Martin Buber. That's the kind of love, too. That's the love that I don't always have for my son, but sometimes I do. Not always. I know that. I move on myself, but sometimes I do. And something was working in Matthew that same way that day. Something external to the hatred that was going on. When they came back on the court in the second half, Matt did a compulsive thing. He didn't think it. He didn't even know what he'd done or the blessing of it until he had done it. His counterpart on the other team, which is also a point guard, had actually made a three-point shot at some distance. And Matt was, of course, guarding him. And when that shot went in, Matt, it was a marvelous shot. And so he just patted the kid on the butt. Boom. And the kid turned around at Matt and he smiled and nodded. Something was here that wasn't that monster. Something was here that allowed others to work together. Now, this is not going to be the full indwelling of love that I'm talking about, but it's something else that you'll see. When Matt saw that, it isn't because, you know, he's marvelous, he's thoughtful and poetic and romantic and all. He just did it again. He started doing that. He started patting people on the butt. And they would turn and they would laugh. He started praising them, and it was like in a little atomic reaction that the players started recognizing one another's capacities and abilities. It was a quiet declaration in this basketball game that the game was the thing, and this relationship that they could establish one to another in some very acceptable rules, that was the thing. And the fact that they were all ball players doing some remarkable things together on this court, that was the thing. And that hatred and that monster and that burning cross and all those people with their watermelons could just go fly. They could just go fly. Here is a cosmos being built with wonderful order. Here is its own novel being written. So that they began literally to play against one another. But this againstness now is not the againstness of warfare or separation. This is the againstment of perfect dialogue. So that at the very end, it was very close, and as Matt tells me, they won. And he says that with a sweetness of spirit. The trouble was, when they started going off the court, one great big fan, sitting above them, started screaming down upon them, started screaming epithets. He was so angry that he called them nigger. He called them nigger. And then two things happened in quick succession. Number one, Bossy's coach, that little apoplectic white guy, blew up. He went clawing up to that fan sitting up there. I mean, it was like clawing, if you could see this guy. He's going to take that guy's head off. And you could see that poor, it was a big guy, and he couldn't move fast. The second thing that happened immediately was that two teams, two mixed, streamed up after our coach. And the big guys on our team put their hands around our coach. And on the other team, they stood in front of that fan. Together, without a single word being spoken, with this sweet interaction of the spirit and a whole other cosmos, a cosmos of a genuine kind of a sympathos one with another, together, they had quickly made a decision that this fight was not going to take place and this was not of them. Remarkable. I'm watching our time, and I think I'm going to need to stop there. I'll just say one or two more words so that you can, all the other things that I was going to read and the wonderful stories I was going to tell you. I learned that I better not, because you'd just be sitting here thinking about dinner. I'll say this and maybe pick up on it on Thursday. This is the Annie Dillard part. And now what happens, the trick of the rake is this, that you forget, she says. You forget and you allow your soul to go out to other people. And then they die or they get hurt. And it doesn't have to be this kind of love at this point that they enter in. They get wounded. And she says, she says the joke is simple. It's like you step on a rake and it cracks you in the forehead and you forget over and over again by allowing yourself to love somebody else and some hurt happens. In this case, it was little Julie Norwich that she liked a lot, didn't love her, but she liked her a lot, whose face was burned off in a plane accident. And for Annie Dillard, it's that wood now. And now what do you do with this? And I will talk a little bit about this on Thursday. When that wood hits you in the forehead, you have the choice to ignore it all. Or in that moment, to realize the chaos and the meaninglessness and the horribleness of this whole universe so that you now go through the pattern or through that process of the collapse of all things with other people who feel that again and again, so that writing becomes its own process of reweaving or rewriting the world. And I want to talk about the Greek word apolemi, which is chandra, perish, but also means loss, the separation. Now we're at the point of actually writing these novels and not just doing it because this is my heart, but in a sense sacrificing self to move through what becomes an existential and painful process in order ultimately to declare a world in which, she would say, divinity begins to find its place and voice. It was always there. But the writer does this really important sacrificial thing. I'm sorry that I should collect this really important thing in the last 2 minutes, but that's what I've done. Anyway, thank you. I'm so happy you came back.